Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Monica Brain. In some places, wild horse populations are growing to the point that they are harming rangeland, waterways, and wildlife habitat. Funding to counteract the problem is also a challenge. In addition, some of the methods to reduce populations, from birth control to slaughter, can be controversial. Coming up, we'll delve into some of the successes and challenges of wild horse management in Native America. Join us for this conversation right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate Nation is keeping an eye on the Keystone Pipeline oil spill. On Thursday, more than 200 gallons of oil leaked in South Dakota west of the tribe's reservation. The CBC reports Chairman Dave Flute says his community is concerned it may impact local waterways. The pipeline carries oil from Canada to the U.S. The spill comes as a Nebraska commission is scheduled next week to consider a proposed sister project by owner TransCanada. The Keystone XL pipeline. Native nations in the U.S. and Canada are among those opposing the Keystone XL project. A Native woman from Canada discussed the oil industry and the health of Indigenous communities at the recent American Public Health Association conference in Atlanta. Keynote speaker Ariel Durange is a leader in the Indigenous tar sands campaign. Melinda Tuhus has more.
Durange spoke about the devastation of Native lands, the contamination of the air and water, the energy industry's use of billions of gallons of fresh water in the process of extracting the tar-like bitumen from the ground, and the impact on human health due to contamination and also to the enforced move away from hunting and trapping to processed foods.
We have lower life expectancies. We're seeing increases of obesity because of bad food choices, diabetes because of bad food choices. We're seeing autoimmune diseases, respiratory diseases caused by climate change and the drivers of climate change. And what's even worse is our communities is dealing with some of the worst kinds and cases of cancer, where we have seen 6 cases of bile duct cancer that are linked to the contaminants found in the oil and gas industry. We are literally dying.
Durange says it's critical for Indigenous voices to be heard.
The battle over the tar sands has come down to a fundamental right to exist as Indigenous peoples and a climate-stable future versus corporate and capitalistic rights to develop. This continues models of colonization through the industrialization of our lands and territory that exacerbate global climate change.
Durange says her people are fighting for self-determination, adding they're experts who've long been caretakers of the environment and should be part of the consultation process. For National Native News, I'm Melinda Tuhus.
A group of about 24 people, including tribal spiritual and religious leaders, are traveling from Albuquerque, New Mexico, to Bears Ears National Monument in Utah. The area is considered sacred to a number of tribes. The Trump administration plans to shrink the protected area. Utah Public Radio's Madeline Mortensen reports.
Shantha Reddy Alonzo is the executive director of Creation Justice Ministries. It's a national organization that works with Christian and Jewish communities to repair the harm that happened to Native people as the United States developed. The organization is directing this weekend's trip.
Part of the process of repenting and of healing racial injustice has been recognizing the importance of sacred places to Indigenous people.
Joseph Brophy Toledo believes it is important for people to come together no matter their religious beliefs.
I'm talking about all Earth people. I'm not just talking about my tribe or Native people. I'm talking about the yellow people, the white people, the red people, and the black people. All Earth people and their belief systems. I respect every one of them.
Alonso says although the trip is focused on Bears Ears, she hopes stronger relationships will be built between religious leaders and tribal spiritual leaders for the long term. And with National Native News, I'm Madeline Mortensen.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
As National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Yate, the Albuquerque Hispanic Chamber of Commerce Convention and Tourism Department welcomes the Navajo Nation Department of Self-Reliance's Turning the Curve General Staff Meeting, November 14th through the 17th. Information on this event and services at siabq.org.
Support by Ramona Farms, offering wholesome and delicious foods from our heirloom crops as our contribution to a better diet for the benefit of all people. We are honored to share our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions online at ramonafarms.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, sitting in for Tara Gatewood. Slaughtering wild horses is one approach to dealing with the growing populations on some tribal lands. But there is pushback by animal rights activists and also some tribal members. Adopting them out to the public is another approach, but demand for wild horses is dwindling. The U.S. Bureau of Land Management spends close to $80 million managing the horses on public lands. Tribes don't have that kind of money and fewer options to keep wild horse herds from growing. The problem is the wild horses consume water, plants, and other resources that would otherwise help sustain livestock and wildlife. Today, we're going to hear from one tribe in Oregon that considers their approach to managing wild horses a success story. We'll also hear about concerns that people have for some management methods. And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think is the best method for dealing with wild horse populations? If you've got something you'd like to share, give us a call. The phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from Portland, Oregon is Bodie Shaw. He is the Northwest Deputy Regional Director of Trust Services for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and he is a member of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. Thanks so much for joining us again, Bodie.
Well, thank you, Monica.
Also joining us now is Jason Smith. He is the president of the National Tribal Horse Coalition, and he is the range manager and ag manager for the Confederated Tribe of Warm Springs, which he is also a member. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you, Monica.
Jason, let's start with you. Before we get into the problems that wild horse herds cause, how did we get here? How is it that wild horses became wild?
How did wild horses become wild? Well, in reality, I believe there always was horses. You know, way back when, they think some say that they come from the Spanish folks, you know, that brought over. But Indian folks say that the horses have always been here. So there was always a form of wild horses. And then recently, I suppose, since the war times and reservations being formed, many say that a lot of the cavalry horses that were released when the people were settled on the reservations, they just kind of turned feral and then turned into wild horses.
And Bodie, give us a sort of a broad picture of the wild horse situation, particularly in your area.
Sure. And thanks again, Monica, for, I think, bringing up a very timely topic that affects much of us and many tribes in Indian country. So in our region, we have 45 tribes and a lot of our larger land-based tribes, like Jason, Warm Springs tribe, Umatilla, Colville, Yakima, as examples, continue to have challenges when dealing with some of the horse populations. I know Jason will talk a little bit about their success stories. But from the Bureau of Indian Affairs standpoint, as the federal trustee to provide oversight for these programs, the big concerns that we are seeing are really some of the degraded conditions in some of the habitats. Many of our tribes in the Northwest region fish as a cultural food staple is so important. And we do see degradation of those environments not only native plants, but really fish and other aquatics, as well as some ecosystem damage. So I think, and what we'll hear a little later today, are those progressive opportunities, I think, programmatically, that tribes are starting to undertake, or in some cases, might need a little assistance. And I think Monica will talk a little bit about what potential options may be, not only for tribes, but I think the Bureau of Indian Affairs as well.
So when you're saying that, like, they're causing problems, I mean, can you give some, like, very specific examples? Because I'm thinking about, like, how is this different from maybe deer populations getting out of control? You know, I've heard of that being a problem, and, you know, hunting sort of brings down that situation, but that's not what can happen with wild horses. So, Bodhi, can you give us a little bit more specific examples of this, of, you know, what they're doing to the landscape?
Sure. I'll give a little perspective, but I think then Jason, as the president of National Horse Coalition, because he's addressed this quite a bit. But from our standpoint, what we try to fund is from an invasive species standpoint, is that unfettered management, so if we have our feral horse, wild horse populations continuing to grow out of control, or once again unfettered or unchecked, we tend to see much more damage. One, you mentioned the wildlife with the horses and impacts that they're causing by continually trampling of native vegetation, affecting some of the fish resources, but also pushing a lot of our historical other large game food staple, deer and elk, into areas that historically they haven't been before, or having that inability to have the deer and elk reach their mortality rates were starting to increase. And and I'll let Jason talk a little bit more from his perspective as the president.
Yeah, Jason, we want to hear from you, but I also want to bring in the federal perspective on this as well. We are talking about wild horse populations on tribal lands today, but they're also on federal lands. And the U.S. Bureau of Land Management deals with wild horses on federal land. They confront many of the challenges when it comes to limiting the size of herds. Jason Litterman is a spokesman for the BLM Wild Horse Management Program, and he gave us some perspective on the current challenge facing those working to find adequate homes for wild horses.
We're really at a crossroads right now. We have 45,000 wild horses in burros that we have not found homes for that are being fed in our off-range facilities that cost American taxpayers about $50 million every year.
And Letterman says the size of wild horse herds increases rapidly, putting a strain on available resources.
As I mentioned, wild horse and burro herds can increase in size pretty rapidly. They grow at about 15% to 20% a year, which means that they can double in size in just 4 or 5 years. And you can imagine any large animal on the range that increases in size at that rate will eventually reach a limit to what the land can support. And so the animals face challenges in finding enough water and enough forage to eat. They're either traveling 10, 20 miles a day to look for water or food, or they're facing issues at their water holes in getting time to drink. Our responsibility is to make sure that the animal population stays at the size that the land can support, so that the animals stay healthy, but also that the land stays healthy, because overpopulated, any animal on the range that becomes overpopulated or is not managed properly can cause damage to the rangeland. These are rangelands that receive 5, 7, 10 inches of rain a year, and so they're very fragile and susceptible to damage by overgrazing. Overgrazing can invite other invasive species into the community, such as cheatgrass, and that's something that's a challenge that we're facing on a lot of our public lands, but especially where we have overpopulation and overgrazing.
That's BLM spokesman Jason Litterman talking about managing horses, wild horse populations on federal land. And that's our conversation today. If you'd like to get in on this conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2000. 1-800-998-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. What do you think are the best ways to manage the wild horse populations, or do you even think that they are a problem? We've got some folks who are saying, yes, we're seeing problems from wild horse populations. What do you think? 1-800-996-2848. Jason Smith is with us. He's the president of the National Tribal Horse Coalition. And Jason, I wanted to give you an opportunity to share a little bit more about what's going on at Warm Springs and what you've been doing to sort of manage that situation.
Yeah, okay. In Warm Springs, horses have always been a part of our culture. You know, they've never really been considered wildlife or an invasive species or nothing. Warm Springs has used our horses as our livestock. And then, you know, it started as early as the mid-90s, but it really hit rock bottom in 2006 when the federal government banned the use of federal funds for horse meat inspection in processing facilities. That was one of the things that really opened our eyes. And you know, you look at it, 20 years have really gone by, and 20 years of hardly doing nothing on our rangelands have really degraded them, you know, big time, from top to bottom, you know, all the way from the high mountaintops clear to the low elevation sagebrush juniper country. So our hands was tied just from Congress and, you know, legislation from back east. So we started to try to figure out a way to manage them, you know, without support, basically, and financial support. And we've really had some success stories. We've put together some crews and kind of gathered them the old-fashioned way, rounding up horses, you know, horseback. When you do that, you got all different ages, sizes, and so forth. And when we got all these horses gathered up, we had some outside agencies come in, and activist groups, actually, and they helped us place these horses. So in reality, you know, from top to bottom, we went all the way around. Some had to go to slaughter, and the younger ones that was really, really good quality horses, they got placed out in the community, not just on the reservation, because we wanted to remove them from the reservation. We had them anywhere in the Northwest, from all the Northwest states, got some of Warm Springs horses. And we've been hearing some really good things about as they've grown, because our program is in year 7 right now. So their yearling got placed, you know, 5 years ago. They're 5 or 6 years old, and we get some good reports that they're turning into great quality horses.
And Jason, did you get pushback from anyone in your community about, I know some tribes consider horses sacred. Was there anyone in your community who was saying, you know, like sending these horses, some of these horses away to slaughter is not a good thing?
For sure. It's always a real sensitive topic when you talk horses, because, you know, from Warm Springs, we consider ourselves horse lovers, you know, and we manage our horses. So there's always that group that says no matter how old, sick, or injured, there's still a use for them, you know. But we've always used our horses as our tool, our livestock, you know, and we gather with, we ride them and so forth. But there's always the group that seems to think no matter what, that horse needs to stay there. You know, the BLM is a prime example of what happens when you're in that situation. You just 45,000 head of horses, housing them year round it's expensive, and we're getting close to that if we don't step up and do something.
Let's take a call. If you want to get in on the conversation today, we are talking about managing wild horse herds. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. We've got Eva in Sea Ranch, California, tuned in on KGUA. Hey there, Eva.
Hi. I was just wondering if you use gelding as part of your management program. I'm sort of familiar with it since I've had to call the vet out to geld three ponies, and I know, well, veterinary services would be greatly welcomed, and hopefully you do welcome veterinary services. I would think that you could go to veterinary colleges like, you know, teachers get discounts for going to areas where they're most needed. Couldn't veterinarians also be enlisted as part of this project to administer gelding?
All right.
That would totally control herds.
Eva, thanks so much for giving us a call from California. And Jason, you know, she brings up an interesting point. What about just taking the existing populations and applying birth control so you're not growing anymore instead of adopting them out or sending them for slaughter?
Now, you asked me... What about using birth control?
Yeah, I mean, Eva mentioned gelding. Isn't that a form of birth control?
Yeah, you know, we're pretty far along on all these things. We geld, you know, 100 to 200 studs a year. Like, in that scenario, when you geld a horse, it works good for quality control, but not quantity, because you got to geld everything for them to not reproduce. There's always something you missed out there. There's always a stud you missed. And if you don't get them all, you're not doing nothing for control purposes. Because that stud that you missed or a handful of studs that you missed, he's going to cover them mares out there. So quality control is really great for gilding. We're involved with some colleges, and we have castration clinics to where they help us, you know, by holding castration clinics, and we help them by giving their students hand-on experience and so forth. The PCP or the sterilization side of things, the way we look at it here in a lot of the Northwest tribes, if you do that, you still have that same number of horses on the range. You're not controlling, you're not reducing numbers. If you're at such a low number, you could probably use that. But we like to the way we look at it, if we don't want that our horse or our livestock to reproduce, then he probably should be moved out of the system. It'd be like sterilizing your cattle. You own your cattle to reproduce, and we have our horses to reproduce. We want the right number of livestock to be on our reservation, and we want the right quality to be there. And if you sterilize them, then they're not reproducing for you.
So it sounds like the perspective that you have is that these wild horses are livestock, actually, not wild animal populations. And so you manage them in a very different way than you would be managing a wild animal population. Is that right, Jason?
That's very right. And, you know, some of the rules and laws that got passed a few years back has tied our hands from doing that.
Yeah, we want to talk more about that, particularly the federal government limiting the ability to slaughter horses. And we want to hear from you. What do you think about that? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. Let's go to Laura in Corrales, New Mexico, tuned in. Hey there, Laura. What would you like to share?
Hello.
Hi, can you hear us?
I'm ignorant about this because I'm not aware of what is and isn't like a sort of indigenous population. I'm calling from the desert Southwest, and I'm also calling because of that really interesting documentary that was done about the reintroduction of the wolves into Yellowstone and how just that one species being reintroduced into the food chain caused a whole lot of environmental and population explosion problems to start getting back in check. And so I'm just curious, and maybe this is an ignorant question, but to what degree has the decimation of predators caused the horse population to get out of control to such a degree?
No, Laura, I think that's a great question, and I want to throw that to Bodhi. You know, is this a situation where we've reduced the predators so much that they're not really, you know, helping out with keeping these populations down?
Well, thanks for that, and thanks, Laura, for the question or the comment. And I, you know, looking at horse populations, and you look at the from a large horse perspective, there's not a lot of predators out there. You may have a bit of cougar, mountain lion damage, and some takes, but really, there is nothing, not many above, that could really put a dent or really start to impact from a predation standpoint horses. I think it does happen. You'll find some kills out in the woods, whether it be from bear or, like I said, mountain lion or cougar, but there really is limited predation on the horses. And so I just don't see that really having much of an impact. And I think that's why, as Jason was alluding to, getting to a state of management where we can control some of the populations or implement some levels of birth control has seemed to work the best here of late. But as you mentioned with the BLM, with Jason mentioning that soundbite, I think we're in a far better position because even though we have limited resources, we're able to control, to some extent, population growth, mortality or natality.
And Bodhi, how much money does the Bureau of Indian Affairs get to manage wild horse populations on tribal lands?
So nationally, we receive zero funding out of appropriations. And I think that's, I'm really happy to have this conversation. We see the disparity, as you mentioned, 2017 BLM budget, $80 million to handle and manage the Wild Horse Borough Program, where here a sister Department of Interior agency, who you look at our national numbers, we're upwards of 100,000 feral wild horse population estimates on the latest GAO report. We've received zero. So the way we try to help, we, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, try to help tribes is through our invasive species funding. But as you talk to a number of our tribes, very limited in amount. And so, yes, we can assist with some of the immediate impacts financially. It's very hard to sustain. And that's something we're hoping to address. And I think a discussion, national discussion like this will definitely help us in trying to at least receive more federal funding to address this challenge. I'm hoping that we get down that road.
We're about to go to a break, but Bodhi, before we go to the break, do you have any resources or areas that where folks could sort of learn more about this issue?
From a tribal perspective?
Yeah,
is that what you're asking?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the Bureau of Indian Affairs on our website, we have a quick overview on, so that's BIA.gov, and you can get into our trust resources programs, and we do have a little snippet talking about the wild horse program, the wild horse challenges, and a little bit of information. But I think Jason may have more online resources of places to go. One thing, and maybe we can get
actually,
to it later. We'll...
Yeah, no, Bodhi, I'm sorry, but we are going to have to go to a break. We'll pick this up right after the break. We're talking about wild horse management today, if you want to get in on the conversation. We'll be right back after this short break. Caring for a family member with Alzheimer's disease or other forms of dementia can be a difficult journey. The confusion and mental degradation of a loved one can take a toll. On the next Native America Calling, we'll talk about approaches to dementia care. We'll also learn how caregivers can avoid getting overwhelmed themselves. We hope you'll join us.
Oh, Boujou, no one is invincible. Young adults can remain on their parents' health insurance until age 26 or sign up for their own. Open enrollment lasts until December 15. Call 1-800-318-2596 or visit go.cms.gov/native health. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Miigwech.
Support by Drumbeat Indian Arts, offering authentic Native American recordings and religious herbs, crafts, supplies, books, and a wide selection of Pendleton blankets. Holiday delivery on orders placed at drumbeatindianarts.com by December 15th.
Welcome back. You are listening to Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, sitting in for Tara Gatewood. Thanks so much for joining us today. Before we get back to our conversation about wild horses, I'd like to invite you to check out our website, nativeamericacalling.com. You can listen to past shows and see what is coming up next and sign up for a weekly newsletter. Today's show is about wild horse management. We're discussing the damage a growing wild horse population can cause and the methods some tribes are using to lower the numbers. If you'd like to share about wild horses, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And I'd like to give a special call out to anyone on the Navajo Nation. I know that that is a pretty serious problem on the Navajo Nation. If you've got something you'd like to share, again, give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. I'd like to bring in a new voice to our conversation. Joining us now is Moses Brings Plenty. He's a representative of the CANA Foundation, a wild horse advocacy organization. And Moses is also a professional actor, and he is Lakota. Welcome to Native America Calling, Moses.
Hello, Monica. How are you doing today?
Good, good. Moses, you know, we covered a lot in the first half about this complicated issue of wild horses. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to, you know, I know that you have a different perspective. Anything you want to share about what we talked about in the first half?
Most definitely. First of all, I want to speak about the horse from a spiritual perspective. The Spanish, they did bring their horses over, but we as Native people, indigenous, the original inhabitants of this country, we've always had horses here. I mean, from a Lakota perspective, we have a word that describes the horse. You know, we have a word that describes an elephant. We have a word or the buffalo. We have a word that describes the elk. We do not have words that describe cattle, elephants, lions, peacocks, so on and so forth. So let's get back to the spiritual cultural perspective and why I think it's very important that we begin to look at different avenues that will help us to sustain our cultural views as indigenous people. Because an identity of a people pertains not to a language, because all of us as human beings are born without a language, but it is pertaining to a way of life. And the horse has always been here. The horse is a bridge between our physical and our spiritual realms. I mean, that we as Lakota people, we are a prime example of that. The Comanche are a prime example of that, so on and so forth. The Nez Perce, we could not go on foot, on our own 2 feet, walk into a herd of buffalo. But on the back of a horse, we are able to go into that herd of buffalo. And when you look at in 1971, there's a Wild Horse Act that was passed. And in that time, there was 47 million acres of public land available. And they assigned 303 herd management areas. And since that time, and since the agents' regulations, we've been reduced down to 179 herd management areas. And that reduced the lands down to only 29 million acres. So it's not the fact that the horses are over-reproducing. They are animals of prey. So anything that is a prey animal, of course, they're going to feel threatened. They want their existence to remain, so of course they're going to go ahead and repopulate. You know, and then, too, we call these the wild Mustangs. Let's get real. If people really learn the true history of this country, they're going to understand and know that these here are they are descendants of confiscated Indian ponies. When our people were forced onto reservations, the first step that this government took was to confiscate our horses to eliminate any means of escape and survival. And so these are the descendants of those there wild horses. These ain't cavalrymen's horses. They gave our people cavalrymen's horses on a reservation. So they swapped out our horses. And so that's the reason why I'm kind of just, I'm just shooken up a little bit about the fact of how we are viewing horses and that we're even having a conversation pertaining and talking about these horses as if they are illegal immigrants of some sort. But in fact, that the great creator placed them here from the very beginning.
Okay, so if you are saying that these wild horse populations, are they not creating damage to, you know, the rangeland and things like that? Like they should be able to just exist without any kind of management?
There has to be some sort of management, but not the kind of management that's going to eliminate any knowledge of our cultural way of life. And so we have to wake up and understand this. And then when lands are reduced, I mean, let's take Indian country, for example. When we were free Roman people, we were well off, but and healthy and strong, no diseases, no sicknesses. But when we were confined, into small territories and small areas, that's when our problems begin. And we are still living with those problems today. And so now we have the same thing that's happening to the horse has occurred to our people. That is the harsh reality. And I'm looking at it from a cultural perspective. And what I'm saying today is not my voice. Yes, it's my voice, but it's the knowledge and understanding that our ancestors had. Their voices that went unheard. And so I'm sharing that today from a spiritual, cultural perspective because my goal in my life is to reconnect and get back to our true identity as indigenous people.
How do we manage these herds from a cultural perspective?
Well, there's someone brought up gilding. Yeah, not everyone can do that, but they also have there's drugs that people can, or there's a dart that you can shoot the mares with that will control their birth. And they won't be able to give birth. It's a birth control. And so, but later on, they would be able to, if you wanted to bring some horses back, you know, or if you lost some, then you can go ahead and not shoot some mares and let them go ahead and breed and go through their natural cycle. Because these herds are actually families. I mean, what we're doing, what's happening to them today is what happened to us when children were sent to Carlisle Indian School and stripped away from their families. I mean, this goes on and on. And again, when we strip that structure, we are stripping a knowledge and understanding of what helps us to become a community again, or a village, however we want to state or put it. You know, because again, I've seen it with my own eyes. A colt lost its mare, its mother, but the other mares within that herd, I'll guarantee you, I've seen that colt today, and she's grown up. If I ask that young filly, have you ever been motherless? She would say, no, I have many moms. I mean, that's how our people used to be. And we want to talk about being indigenous people and talk about cultural being, you know, understanding a cultural way. Then what's wrong with us as the people to stand up for our right as indigenous people and the rights of those who shared a knowledge with us, who showed us how to live so we didn't have to pray every other day or once a week, whatever. We live that prayer every single day. So, yeah, there has to be a type of management, yes, but we have to do it in the most humane way possible that is not going to destroy that trust that we can establish, reestablish as human beings with the horse nation, which, again, is our passageway to the spiritual realm.
Moses Brings Plenty, thank you for sharing that with us. And if you want to get in on the conversation, we want to hear from you. What do you think about wild horse management? Are horses sacred to your tribe? Give us a call and share. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's go to Patience in Placitas, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Hey there, Patience. What would you like to share?
Yes, good morning. This is a great show, and thank you. And thank you so much, Moses, for what you just said. It is so right on. I want to say, I know there's people that look at horses as livestock, and Moses addressed that very well. But what I'm going to say is going to address both people who look at horses as wildlife families, wild families, or just free-roaming families, and people who look at them as livestock. So, and then we're going to address the population of horses on Navajo land. Okay, so I'm in New Mexico, and as Moses said, whether you look at a horse as livestock or as a family, the darting with birth control works, and it works better than the gelding, just because you can dart from 50 meters on the ground. You can go up in helicopter and dart, and you can actually dart from a helicopter humanely. So people, this is the best kept secret, and you are the first to get it out to a broad audience, because I'm going to read to you PCP.
Actually, patients, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I apologize, but we have a number of calls on the line, and we want to include as many voices as we possibly can to the conversation. Patients, thanks so much for giving us a call from Positas, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Let's go to Philip in Albuquerque, tuned in on KUNM as well. Hey there, Philip, what would you like to share?
I'm from Cuba, and we have cows that we put down to pasture in the Navajo Nation in the wintertime for 100, generations. And I think the horses are destroying the pasturing, just too many grazing. I'm assuming that's what it is, but we have horses. They're a great tool, but I think that we're spending too much money trying to, the guy said, $45 billion? I've seen people on the Navajo Nation, they could use that money for other things. Maybe they should just slaughter most of those horses.
Philip, thanks for your perspective. Bodhi Shaw from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, I want to bring you back in. Philip threw out a number, but I think it's not in the billions that they're spending. Did you want to clear that up?
Yeah, so this is specific to the Bureau of Land Management. 2017 federal appropriations, just over $80 million for the management and care of the Wild Horse Burrow program, specific to the Bureau of Land Management.
All right. And let's take a few more calls. Again, if you want to get in on this conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. It's a pretty controversial issue. How do we manage wild horse populations? Do you consider wild horses livestock, or are they actually wildlife when they're living in herds out on the range? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. Let's go to Bruce in Albuquerque, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Hey there, Bruce.
Hey, I'm always amazed in these discussions about horse management that almost nothing is said in parallel about the damage done by cattle and the fact that the fees paid by so-called ranchers, many of which are completely neglect their stock, like the Clive and Bundy situation, where they're allowed, or just by tacit practice, they're allowed to let their cattle roam at random and do whatever damage they do. And the amount of damage done by cattle is enormous, especially to riparian areas. And then they're up in arms when there's any predation of their stock. And so it's ranchers primarily who are lobbying to keep horses from running wild, when it is true that it was government policy that made that happen and essentially caused horses to go wild. But horses are a wild species, whereas cattle have been altered to the point where they can't survive in a situation like that. So you have what is essentially a native species, horses, which are recovered from another continent, yes, but they are a Native American species. And then you have an invasive species, the cattle, that are a drain on our economy, destroy the land in a way that horses never will. And especially if predators are reintroduced, then horses will be harried the way deer are, and their populations will be controlled. I've read articles about that, and I believe that the wolves, when they're introduced, will serve that purpose.
All right, Bruce, thanks for giving us a call. Let's go to Kate in Bend, Oregon. Hey there, Kate.
Hi. I want to first applaud Native American Calling, as well as Jason and Bodhi and all these other people that are working so hard to come up with solutions to this challenge. So I see a radical difference between management of tribal horses as opposed to management of the federally protected wild horses. In reference to the tribal horses, there's quite a conundrum. And I see it in this conversation. Bodhi is pointing out that the only smidge of funding that they're able to find is the invasive species funding to help manage these horses on Warm Springs. And I hear Jason saying that they are a very desired animal of considered livestock. And it's quite a conundrum to have livestock, desired livestock, being considered invasive. And I think if we have a shift of perspective, that we may be able to find a management program that would be more effective. And I just want to throw that out there with a big old thanks for everyone addressing this challenge.
Yeah, Kate, that's a good perspective, and I want to throw that back to all of our guests. You know, could this problem be resolved in a way that both respects culture and helps deal with the management situation if we have a shift of perspective? Bodhi, let's start with you.
Yeah, and I want to thank Kate for that comment, and I do appreciate that because, you know, we have 567 federally recognized tribes, and not one of them is the same. So perspectives differ, and the invasive species funding that we use is basically the only pot of money we have to assist the tribes, and we've got to that point through tribal consultation. What's going to be the best way? How can we best spend our funding that way? So, yeah, it's probably a little bit of a misnomer, but still, that's our only pot of money. And, you know, the one thing, and I agree completely with what Kate's saying, and I hear Moses as well, is that the federal authority, we have service-first authority, which means that we can actually collaborate with our federal partners in agriculture and interior. And so my hope is, and we'll continue this conversation, is that we'll be able to tap into some of that original intent behind the Wild and Free Roaming Horses and Burro Act of 1971, which established the Bureau of Land Management component for management, leading to, as we just heard, just over $80 million. I think tribes have the autonomy, the sovereign right to move forward and start looking at management opportunities that we can work and tap into some of these funding for proper management of this issue.
Moses, what do you think about the idea that if we just were able to sort of shift our perspective, we could maybe come together with some sort of compromise? Is there a compromise when it comes to this issue?
I think it's very important that we all come together and work side by side. I mean, Sitting Bull said it the best. Let's put our minds together and see what kind of world we can make for the children and generations to come. We're at that point because when we talk about the environment or our existence or our problems, I mean, there was a gentleman just earlier that talked about how the money could be used on the Navajo reservation. Well, that's what happens when you confine a group of people. When you confine people, you confine horses, you confine buffalo. I mean, you can find anything. There's always going to be problems, poverty, sickness, so on and so forth. And so we have to come together. We all have to come together and figure out the best solutions that is going to revitalize the culture for people, for a people, the original inhabitants of this continent, and then to also find humane solutions for the horses. As I stated before, I mean, cattle, when they eat, they pull up the grass from their roots. Horses cut the grass. I mean, again, we can go on and on, but it's very important that we all come together as people and think about and discuss, have many discussions, whether they're going to be the best solutions for the generations to come. It's not us today and not our pocketbooks, but for the generations to come and our spirituality.
Moses, do you have thoughts about like having conversations, though, with native cattle ranchers who are, you know, just trying to make a living, just trying to be able to provide for their families and their communities? And what they see as these horses as an invasive species really kind of taking over the resources. How do you have that conversation with them about, you know, that slaughtering these horses is not the right approach?
I would like to know what that proof. What is their proof of how the horses are destroying? I mean, because and we all have these allegations. I mean, look, we use the term invasive species, right? If you look up that word, it defines as a living organism that is not native to an ecosystem and causes harm. The original horses of this continent are not invasive species. If you want to know what's invasive, then you look at the domesticated animals. Because the original animals, the earlier when you started the show, you asked, what makes the horse wild? How did they become wild? Well, you know what? We're all born wild, but we're taught something different. And we were taught how to be civilized. We've learned how to be civilized. I mean, my ancestors were wild, if we want to use that term. And to me, wild means it is an animal or a creature that understands how the great creator designed the world to function, the ecosystem to function, and they know their role and they do their part. Outside of that, they do not. Now, you look at us today as people, human beings are the most invasive species because we are, again, born without a language. We're born without the ability to walk. And so to get back to the cattlemen, our family ranchers on the reservations, you know what? I stand up for them too because I want them to be successful. I mean, on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation alone, last year there was $53 million made through agriculture. Less than a third of that was made by Native people. The other amount of that was made by non-Native people. And so right now I'm going through some issues right now back home on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation because we're trying to get our lease back, our family land back through the leases, but I'm going up against a non-Native who seems to have more rights than I do on a reservation. And so, I mean, and that's all through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I mean, I can't say that it's not anyone else's fault, but I just want to know where are our rights as Indigenous people. I want our family ranchers to succeed. I want the small family rancher to succeed. Now, as far as corporate cattlemen go, that's a corporate ranchers. That's a different story. I want our family ranchers to succeed because that's true independence. And that's true sovereignty.
All right. Thanks, Moses, for that. And Jason, I want to bring you back into the conversation. We've covered a lot of area. We were just speaking with Moses about the extent of the damage that wild horses cause versus the extent of the damage that humans cause or cattle cause. I just wanted to give you an opportunity if you had something you'd like to share about that.
You know, I work for the branch of natural resources as the range and ag manager for the tribe, and the branch of natural resources is kind of like the top of the umbrella under the branch of natural resources, range and ag, cultural resources, fish and wildlife, water and soils, forestry, fire management, and so forth. And when you get, you know, thousands and thousands of horses that have been left unmanaged for years, they tend to affect all those different disciplines in a way, you know, and, you know, all the way from, you know, the roads to water quality, fisheries habitat, you know, sediment in the streams, just from bare soils, you know, anytime they get a rain event or snow, when they melt off, it kind of sends some of the stuff down there, you know. So there's a lot of negative impacts from overpopulation of wild horses. A managed system is perfect, so that's all we're looking for is to being able to manage our horses and finding out for our horses, you know, in a good way.
Absolutely. And Bodhi, let's talk a little bit more about funding. You say that there's very little funding for this. If you were able to sit down with the appropriators, you know, at an appropriation committee and really ask for an amount of money to be able to manage this problem, what would you, you know, what would be the range of what you'd ask for? Bodhi?
Can you hear me?
Yes, sorry. Did you hear the question?
I did. And that's something that we've tossed around as we look at approaching our federal appropriators, knowing the disparity. Once again, $80 million for our sister agency in Interior for wild horse management, borough management, and we receive nothing. One thing that we've looked at in terms of calculations, it may take upwards of $2,000, $2,500 per head for management. That's capture, feeding, that includes a labor for your range riders to get that horse to either an adoption, rescue, or to the sale yards, approximately. So in approaching that and looking at our numbers again, we felt pretty comfortable if we could get with our appropriators and kind of push into the $2 to $3 to $5 million range to start a management program that we can assist our tribes, Navajo, our Northwest tribes, the Interior Columbia Basin tribes, in managing this issue. And so that's something we really want to. We would hope to have on this call a legislator who pushed on the Government Accountability Office on helping us find some answers. But I hope we have another show to pick up this conversation, and we could do that.
Absolutely. It's definitely something that we keep an eye on here at Native America Calling, because it affects not only our Native nations, but federal lands in general. And if you want to learn more about this, we're going to put some links up on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. In particular, we'll put up a link to the CANA Foundation, which is the wild horse advocacy organization that Moses Brings Plenty is from. And thanks so much to everybody that called in and shared today about this conversation. Like I said, we'll definitely keep an eye on it and revisit it in the future. Thanks to Bodie Shaw, Jason Smith, and Moses Brings Plenty for sharing their opinions. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our associate producer is Andy Murphy. Sol Treviso produced our show today. Roman Garcia is our engineer. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor and producer of National Native News. Tara Gatewood is our host. I'm senior producer Monica Brain. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support by Amerind Media Group, offering compelling and entertaining films, TV series, and documentaries about the indigenous peoples from around the world. We are honored to share their cultures, traditions, and stories online with a no-charge trial at nativeflix.com. Support by the Sisseton, Wahpeton, Oyate Tribes, Dakota Western Corporation, and SWO Plastics. Commercial-strength trash bags from 3 to 65 gallons for industrial use by casinos, the IHS, and more. DakotaWesternCorp.com. Support by the Association of American Indian Physicians, Healthy, Active Native Communities. HANK works with communities to implement effective strategies that promote obesity prevention, improved nutrition, and physical activity based on each community's individuality. Information on promising practices, nutrition and fitness programs, and shared successes at hank.aaip.org.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.